From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The U.S. election. What did Russia have to do with it? Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is To the Point. Yesterday, President Trump conceded that Russia did try to interfere in last year's election after all, presumably to help him win. He blamed the Obama administration for not taking action, and many Democrats agree. But a lot of questions remain. What was Russia up to? Special Counsel Robert Mueller is trying to find out. He's reportedly focused on Russian money laundering and organized crime, especially in London. We'll look at the team that Mueller's assembled and what their specialties reveal about his investigation. Also today, a mixed ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. President Trump has the power to ban some travel, but there will be hearings next fall. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Robert Mueller was named special counsel to investigate intelligence agency findings that Russia tried to help Donald Trump get elected. Now, President Trump has conceded that did happen, but he says the Obama administration failed to take any action. Meantime, it appears that Mueller is focused on money laundering and organized crime, and we'll talk about that in the second half of our program. First, the U.S. Supreme Court reached a unanimous decision today, sort of. President Trump has the constitutional power to instigate a travel ban from six mostly Muslim countries. Part of his order will be allowed to go forward, but there will still be hearings next October after the summer recess. Chris Geidner is legal editor for BuzzFeed News. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, fine, except I can't figure this out. The Supreme Court voted 9-0. It also voted 6-3. How could it do both things at the same time?
Well, I mean, we don't know that it voted 9-0.
Okay.
I mean, all that we know is that the Supreme Court issued a per curiam decision, which means for the court, and it was a ruling, an order on two requests, requests to grant certiorari to hear the case, and rulings on the request to stay the lower court injunctions. Neither of those actions by the court require the court to give out its vote count. And so we don't actually know the vote count. We don't know. Justices don't need to issue dissents if they don't want to on either cert petitions or stay applications. And so all that we know is that the court, which means at least five justices, agreed with each of the actions taken in that per curiam decision on the stay applications and cert petitions.
Okay. The Fourth Circuit Court and the Ninth Circuit Court both said that they wanted to put a hold on the travel bans and didn't think that they were appropriate. And they used language that the president used himself during the campaign in order to justify those rulings. So now we have President Trump today saying, I'm particularly gratified that the Supreme Court's decision was 9-0. You're saying that's not true?
I am saying that we do not have the information to be able to say that.
Okay.
We just don't. I mean, Bush v. Gore was a per curiam decision. Go back and look at it. Obviously, that was not a 9-0 decision.
So why is it that people are claiming that, and they're also claiming that the decision to let the that there was also a 6-0 decision? Explain that again, and what was that, and how is it different from the 9-0 alleged 9-0?
I don't even know what you mean.
Wow. So other people are reporting this, but it's questionable, I take it.
I mean, I think that I mean, it's hard for me. I mean, I have been covering stay applications and cert petitions for the past several terms in the course of covering all of the marriage cases, in the course of covering death penalty cases. I've probably looked at and read more stay applications than hardly anybody, basically probably among the like 10 people who don't work for the justices themselves in the country. And you have lots of times that for strategic reasons or other reasons that when you have a stay application, I mean, a lot of the times, look at when we have these death penalty cases that come up to the court, that people ask for a stay of execution. And there are lots of times that justices won't note their dissent. And so that's why we can only say that there were two noted dissents, or there were no noted dissents, because we don't actually know, because the court doesn't publish what the votes are on stay applications or cert grants.
Okay. In the meantime, we do know that the travel ban will be allowed to go forward between now and the time that the Supreme Court holds new hearings, which will be after its summer recess in October. We're going to continue and talk a bit more about this as we go on today. But Chris Gardner, what guidance can you give people right now who are undoubtedly confused about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we need to do is talk with the administration. I think reporters are doing that. I think it's unfortunate that the White House press briefing is going to be off camera again today. It would be really helpful for the administration to actually do these things on camera. And we need to find out what it is that the administration thinks they're going to be doing, how they believe they're going to implement this in the coming days. I mean, keep in mind that the court only partially granted the stay. And so, therefore, there is this limit for those with bona fide connection to people in the U.S. or to groups in the U.S. And so it's not exactly clear, depending on who you're talking to. The administration is framing this as basically a big win for them, and that they get to put into effect most of the ban, but then the ACLU is saying that this is actually a very narrow win for the administration.
All right. Hang on. We're going to continue this. Chris Gardner will be with us some more as we go forward. We'll talk to others as well.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on All Day Back with To The Point, talking about a confusing decision today by the U.S. Supreme Court, or perhaps a couple of confusing decisions. One is reported to be 9-0, the other 6-3. I think I misspoke earlier and said it was 6-0, but it was 6-3. Josh Blackman is with us, professor of constitutional law, South Texas College of Law in Houston, also an adjunct scholar at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Can you clarify this for us today? Did we have two decisions? Were they 9-0 and 6-3, or do we simply not know, as Chris Gardner indicated?
Well, thank you for having me back. I think the actual count is less important than the fact that there were no dissents, and that's what the president was probably getting at. The lower courts have consistently ruled against President Trump, and here, without any recorded dissent, the court gave a victory to the president. And I'd like to comment
for
on...
For what? Victory for what?
Oh, I'll tell you exactly what.
Okay.
The revised executive order imposed a travel ban on people from six nations, but there were waivers built into this order, which people aren't talking much about. And the waiver said that if you had some sort of employment relationship, an educational opportunity, or a close family relationship, you would be able to apply for a waiver. And if you can show a hardship, you would be admitted in. What the court did today was to codify the hardship exemptions. This is not a defeat for the president. This is more or less agreeing with him that he specified in the order that certain people with these hardships would very likely be given an exemption. The court said you don't even need to prove the hardship. As a matter of course, because of your relationship to the United States, you are now going to be allowed to enter. This is a point I haven't seen reported much, but if you actually read the executive order, this is following the path that Trump himself set back in March.
What about the fact that they're still going to have hearings, even though they gave the president a victory in this regard?
Well, the hearing part is actually somewhat quirky. President Trump said he would only need 90 days of this order to be in effect. We're now at the end of June, count 90 days forward. That puts us at the end of September. By the beginning of October, when the court returns from its warm summer vacation, this case may very well be moot. This might be the last time the court actually issues a decision on the merits. This may be it. So in that sense, I see this as something of a compromise. The court reversed the lower courts, disagreed with what they ruled, gave Trump a victory, but the justices may never need to actually get into this very meaty separation of powers question.
Okay, this 90-day limitation raises all kinds of questions. The original order was in January. Then it was modified somewhat in March, as you indicated. Now there's been a ruling on it, and hearings aren't scheduled until after another 90-day period has expanded. Now, here comes a statement from President Trump himself saying this unanimous Supreme Court decision is a clear victory for national security. And he says again, I am also particularly gratified that the Supreme Court's decision was 9-0. What about the question of national security? Juliette Kayyem is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. She's now on the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and she's CNN's security analyst and author of a book called Security Mom. Good to have you back on our show.
Thank you so much, Warren.
What about the dangers involved? What does the president mean when he says this is a clear victory for national security? How is it? How was it compromised before the order went into effect?
Well, it wasn't, and I think President Trump sort of is taking a victory lap when the issue of the national security implications of both what would justify the ban and then, of course, what the Supreme Court today were actually just not resolved. For one, the issue of people coming into this country being a security risk was never factually based. It was just an assertion in an executive order. If you actually drill down on the data, it's just clearly not true. Our biggest threat here, unfortunately, is homegrown. But nonetheless, that issue was not resolved as a factual matter by any court because the injunctions were put in by the lower courts so quickly. Then the Supreme Court just simply did not address that issue and really did a hardship exception. You know, people who are here who have ties, it's simply unfair to keep them from the people that they know here or the conditions that would have brought them here in the first place. So I think we have a tendency to read too much into this, and President Trump certainly does. This was unanimous in the sense it was unanimous in that it resolved not a lot of the big issues. It will, and I agree that I think part of what the court is doing is trying to buy out some time so they don't get to the more difficult constitutional question: is what is a president's immigration authority, authority to set conditions of immigration absent legislation. I think that is the big issue that hopefully the court clearly seems to me wants to punt.
Chris Geidner, I know you need to leave us again, legal editor for BuzzFeed News, but do you think the court did or did not rule on the power of the executive to issue a ban of this kind?
I mean, I do think there, when Josh said this could be the last time that the court rules on the merits, I'd say two things. One, I don't think this is a ruling on the merits. This was a ruling on stay applications and on cert petitions, on whether the court should halt the ban while or halt the injunctions while considering the case and whether they'd consider the case. But I do think he's right that a lot of the underlying questions might end up getting resolved before the court can actually hear the case. And so we might have to put off the actual big, tough questions that Josh and others have been fighting about over the past 6 months, either indefinitely or until another case like this comes up in the future.
Chris Geidner, once again, legal editor for BuzzFeed News. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Professor Blackman, back to you at the South Texas College of Law. Is this a kind of slapdown by the Supreme Court to the lower courts, especially in the age of Twitter, when we have the president saying, hey, this is a unanimous support for my policy?
Well, I think this sends a fairly powerful signal to the lower court. The lower courts held, and this goes to the question we asked Chris a moment ago, that the president didn't make the requisite national security findings to exclude anyone. They said he didn't make the showing that these people be dangerous. I disagree. The court ruled today that he could exclude some people under this authority. It's not a ruling on the merits, so to speak, but it is an affirmation that he does have the power under the existing executive order to exclude a certain number of people that he wanted to exclude anyway. And to return to your question, the second part, the court didn't rely on his Twitter. They didn't rely on his, you know, Facebook page. They didn't rely on his campaign statements. And I sincerely hope that the lower courts can take a hint and recognize that they ran afoul by looking beyond the four corners of the executive order. That's all the Supreme Court limited the review to, and that's what the lower court should as well.
Didn't they say that it was campaign rhetoric about a Muslim ban, which he continued to call a Muslim ban again and again, that troubled them, that it sounded like it was a religious limitation being put on immigration?
Absolutely. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the president's executive order was tainted by this animus from the from his campaign trail statements. If, in fact, the executive order is tainted, then it's tainted for everyone, right? You can't say, well, he's tainted for people of bona fides, but not for people with ethnic bona fides.
So is the U.S. Supreme Court saying it wasn't tainted after all?
Well, I think what the court's saying is that the policy wasn't infected by this animus, that if it can be applied to some people, then maybe it could be applied to all people once we get through the proper resolution. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's significant discussion of the merit question here.
Juliet Kayyem, back to you. Once again, you dealt with Homeland Security at the Department of Homeland Security. I understand the ACLU is going to be watching very carefully at the airports, going out to make sure that people do, if they have an employment arrangement, an educational connection, a family connection, or some other hardship, they get in.
That's right. There's 2 points to this. So the first is, even proponents of Trump and the legal theory behind this should want a very exacting enforcement of this. Why is that? Because of the because we are a nation in competition with other nations. Many of us in Homeland Security have long feared, you're starting to see the data of what we're calling the Trump slump, the economy, vacationers, travelers, students, who will simply say it's not worth coming to this country anymore. And you see that in the data, particularly in tourism. So we want exacting, vigorous enforcement because you don't want it to be overbroad. But then this gets to the second point about how, you know, the court did not rely on his Twitter or Facebook or whatever. That may be true. But one of the challenges of you know, the Trump administration is, there are these statements, very uncareful, one might even call them sloppy statements, you know, in only so many characters on Twitter. And what I think the administration, certainly the White House, forget is, you know, this stuff needs to be operationalized. And so to the extent that the original executive order sort of came out of the White House, the Customs and Border Protection had never been briefed. TSA had never been briefed. The Secretary of Homeland Security apparently found out about it on CNN. One of the reasons why we need government to work is because even if you disagree with the policy, it is simply unfair to leave the burden of interpretation to a 23-year-old CBP agent who really only knows how to stop things. He really doesn't know how to guide them. And so I think part of what is really important now is that whatever you feel about the substance, that the enforcement is as exacting as possible, and that means that the Trump White House takes seriously its obligations to make government run effectively, even in this interim period.
Josh Blackman with the Cato Institute. Does that sound right to you?
I think it's right. I don't want chaos, right? I don't want people getting stuck at the airports. I think that's an absolute shame. And the Homeland Security Department has said that they would issue detailed guidance to ensure people don't get stuck at the airports. So if this is implemented in a more careful manner, perhaps it might also suggest to the courts that the Trump administration is serious about this, and they're not simply doing this for partisan political points, whatever else. But the point that's worth stressing is now they can actually implement this order. And the sorts of people who they wanted to keep out, that is people from these six nations who have zero connection with the United States, can now be denied entry. And they have a full 90 days to do this. So at bottom, this is more or less what Trump wanted. We haven't discussed refugees. The refugees as well can be denied entry under this. And as long as they lack a bona fide relation to a U.S. citizen or something else, they can be kept out. The fact of the matter is often refugees don't have those sorts of connections to U.S. persons. They are indeed people who have to rely on our good graces for entry. They can be denied at a far greater number than those who have connections to the United States.
So, Juliette Kayyem, is it true then that the refugees are the most likely to have zero connection to the United States?
Absolutely. They're also the ones who are not, basically it takes 18 to 24 months to onboard them because of the rigorous screening process already. I mean, people like me who knew the screening process, you know, you could call it whatever you want. For refugees, it'd be hard to make it more extreme. And so what I think we're all waiting for is operational guidance for what it doesn't mean when the president says more extreme vetting. Because remember, after the terrorist attacks last year, in particular in Europe, there were changes to the vetting system, including for our visa waiver countries, those that the Europeans in particular that don't normally need any sort of vetting. We used to have a quid pro quo that we could go there and they could come here visa free. Even those processes had been tightened. So what I'm looking for, even though I view this as I view the entire apparatus that Trump had started with the early executive order as a political statement, not a national security statement. But now that parts of it are reinstated, it's the obligation of those who are in charge not to do a victory lap, but to make this work as effectively as possible. And even, as I said, the proponents of this should want that as well, because we have a tendency to look in the United States to think that we're fabulous and, everyone wants to come here. The truth is we will soon discover, as we already are in some areas, that we are a very unwelcoming country right now.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you just in the interest of time. I want to ask Josh Blackman one more question. When you said that this might be moot by October, does that depend on the kind of clarity being asked by both yourself and Juliette Kayyem?
Well, I think what it depends on is whether or not President Trump issues another executive order. It's entirely possible that after this 90-day period, President Trump says, okay, now we need a permanent ban. Don't forget, this was a temporary ban. So I think regardless of whatever chaos ensues over the summer, if the president decides he needs a permanent ban on immigrants from certain countries, that meets certain conditions, that this can go far beyond October.
All right. Here we go, trying to figure out what the Supreme Court has done and what the president will do in the aftermath. Juliette Kayyem, again, formerly with the Department of Homeland Security during the Obama administration. Josh Blackman with the Libertarian Cato Institute, professor at South Texas College of Law, and our earlier guest, Chris Geidner, with the BuzzFeed News. Thank you all. In a moment, the U.S. election, Russian money laundering, and organized crime. To the Point from Public Radio International.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman Olney back with To the Point. Up until now, President Trump and his staff have been bitterly critical about the consensus of all U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia tried to influence last year's election with the goal of helping Mr. Trump win. Well, on the cable show Fox and Friends today, the president not only conceded the point, he blamed the Obama administration for not taking action.
Well, I just heard today for the first time that Obama knew about Russia a long time before the election, and he did nothing about it. But nobody wants to talk about that. That the CIA gave him information on Russia a long time before they even, you know, before the election.
Scott Horton is professor at Columbia Law School, contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
I want to talk further about the investigation by the special prosecutor, special counsel. But before we do, how significant is it that Mr. Trump seems to have suddenly decided that there was, in fact, interference by the Russians during his campaign?
Well, in fact, I think if we track back over the last 72 hours, I've seen at least three different positions he's taken. But you're right. I think this does seem to be a more robust embrace of the Russia hacking issue as an issue than we've heard in any prior statement from Trump. But, of course, it's going back to what was one of the consistent themes of Trump during the 2016 campaign, which is blame Barack Obama.
Okay, so let us go forward and take a look at the Mueller investigation, who he's hired, and what that tells us about where he might be going. What can you tell us?
Well, I think it's always a little bit dangerous to guess on the basis of talent picked where he's going. But nevertheless, I think in this case, we see some areas being highlighted, and we see him reaching very, very deep for expertise and talent dealing with Russian organized crime. And there's no doubt we've got two people who are key stars within the Department of Justice system in that area, Andrew Weissman, who was a key figure in the New York prosecutorial effort going after the Russian organized crime penetration of the New York market in the 1990s and aughts. And then Lisa Page, who was the head of a field office that the U.S. set up in Budapest to deal with Eastern European, but also especially Russian organized crime. And she had a special focus, which was dealing with the most famous of all the Russian mob kingpins, a man named Semyon Mogilevich, who for a time figured on the 10 most wanted list, and who appears in the fringe of this story concerning Trump and the Trump organizations dealing with Russia at many points. And then there's a third person, Elizabeth Priliger, who studied in Russia and speaks fluent Russian. So it's quite clear that this is a particularly valued set of resources for
him. Tell us more about the Trump organization and its contacts with some of the people that you mentioned.
Well, we know when there was the major investigation that was run in the 90s that lasted for about 15 years, that investigation came to a focus at several points on Trump and Trump real estate projects. For instance, it concluded that a large number of Russian mobsters and capos had acquired apartments in Trump Tower. That seemed to have been their preferred residence. It found gambling operations, prostitution operations going on in some of these buildings. And it also focused at several points on a couple of key individuals who were involved in raising money for the Trump organization, one of the most prominent of whom is Felix Sater. And of course, his own criminal record was placed under seal, so it's been very difficult to get information about him and his role. But he flashed a business card that described himself as a special advisor to Donald Trump, and he's been photographed many times standing at Trump's side.
You didn't mean to say that gambling and prostitution were going on in the apartments in Trump Tower, did you?
Yes. There was an investigation looking at gambling and prostitution going on in Trump Tower. Yes.
Okay. And, of course, Mr. Trump's son has said from time to time that we have plenty of money because we have access to the Russians. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, they've stated at one point, Eric Trump stated at one point that hundreds of millions were raised. And more recently, he's denied allegations to that effect. But I guess we have it both ways in recorded statements from the Trump sons.
Scott Horton again at Columbia Law School. Luke Harding is a foreign correspondent for The Guardian. He's author of several nonfiction books, the latest of which is A Very Expensive Poison, that talks about the 2006 murder of Alexander Litvinenko. That was a very sensational case. Luke Harding, good to have you back with us.
Great, Warren. Good to talk to you again.
Tell us a little bit more about Russian organized crime and how it's tied to the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you have to understand about the Russian state is it's less of a state than really a kind of organized crime syndicate. And the person you just mentioned, Alexander Litvinenko, who was killed in 2006 with a radioactive cup of tea, this essentially was his thesis. And what he said was that the government, the Kremlin, if you like, the FSB spy agency, which is the successor to the KGB, and organized crime had merged into a sort of more or less a kind of single entity. And I think if you look at the kind of mayhem that's been taking place over the last year or so in the U.S., but also in my backyard in Europe, you sort of see two things going on, one of which is this kind of influence operation to try and tweak the U.S. election, if you like, and to help Donald Trump. But the other, I think, is more longstanding, and it's the whole money laundering aspect. It's you steal money in Russia, and then basically what you have to do is you have to offshore it or you have to put it in Western banks so it's safe so that other people don't steal it from you. But the people who do this are very sophisticated, and it's a marriage, if you like, of political objectives with financial obfuscation.
Do you put it not just in Western banks, but also in Western real estate?
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, one of the things about Putin that he's so clever at is he's clever at exploiting the sort of porous nature of Western society, whether that's our political system, our democracy, voting, or actually our economic system. And we've seen a tremendous amount of this. I mean, I was one of the journalists who spent 6 months investigating the Panama Papers and tracking down Putin's money. And we found this extraordinary trail going from Russia, from Russian banks to Cyprus, to offshore entities in the Caribbean and the British Virgin Islands, then back into Russia again. And I think there's a kind of big unanswered question about, firstly, as Scott was saying, how much money has been funneled into Trump organization kind of real estate, but also how much is being bounced through the American financial system.
What about the connection to Vladimir Putin and how solid it is? You seem to speak as if Mr. Putin and the Russian state slash organized crime syndicate are one and the same.
Well, I mean, the thing, I spent 4 years in Russia. I was there as the Guardian's Moscow bureau chief until I got kicked out in 2011. And it's not Prussia. It's not a kind of ruthlessly efficient system with Putin as the kind of uber gremlin pulling the strings. But at the same time, he does absolutely set important strategic and geopolitical priorities. So, for example, the murder of Litvinenko, a public inquiry here last year found that Putin had probably approved the operation. And he said himself that he micromanaged the annexation of Crimea. So of course, his subordinates can do their own thing when it comes to money dubious bank accounts and so on. But a major operation like the U.S. election, like the whole Trump project, like, if we're to believe the dossier by Christopher Steele, the former British MI6 officer about Trump, like the project to kind of push money towards Trump, these are decisions made at the top of the Russian state.
That dossier is one that's very controversial. Apparently, it is floating around in almost every news organization in the country. I'm sorry to say I don't have one, but a lot of other people do. And it evidently appears to chronicle very unsavory activities by Mr. Trump, among others. Scott Horton, back to you at the Columbia Law School. What about the Trump bankruptcies? He went bankrupt several times, and there are reports that American banks didn't want to help him out and that the Russians did. Is that right?
I think that's right. So I think that clearly that's one of the things that's being examined here. So we're looking at individuals in this team who have that kind of expertise, who have focused for decades on money laundering, and especially money laundering involving Russian oligarchs and Russian organized crime. And I think the clear focus here is on the period after 2004. Remember that Donald Trump filed a series of bankruptcies with his operations in New Jersey right at the center. There's broad discussion of him actually being bankrupt this time back in 2004. The major institutions who had lines of credit to Trump terminated them at that time. And so the real question was how, after 2004, was he able to launch some of these major projects? And I think that's where we look at things like the Toronto Tower Project, which has recently been studied by the Wall Street Journal, or Trump Soho, which has been studied by the Financial Times and the New York Times. In both cases, we see a really undeniable signs of the involvement of Russian organized crime in the financing and the fundraising for those projects. So I think we're going to see a deep, boring exercise into the source of funding for these projects.
So we began by talking about the people that the special prosecutor, the special counsel had hired to look into all of this. Are you suggesting that this is fertile ground, given what you just told us?
I think certainly. The question is exactly how far it's going to go. But, of course, we had, as you noted earlier, Warren, you know, we had Donald Trump's own son bragging at one point that hundreds of millions of dollars were coming out of Russia. And that seems to be almost certainly correct based on the numbers that have already surfaced and have been reviewed in the newspapers. But most of the financing has been deeply obscured, involving long chains of offshore entities. And that's the sort of thing that it's very, very difficult for journalists and newspapers to break through that and get to the bottom of it. But the FBI has tools that will allow it to do so in a proper criminal investigation. So I think that's what we're going to see now under the leadership of Mueller.
And the special counsel does have the resources of the FBI to pursue his work. Anders Osland is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He worked as an economic advisor to the president of Ukraine from 1994 to 1997. He is a specialist on economic policy in Russia and Ukraine and Eastern Europe in general. And welcome back to our program. Good to have you again.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Why is so much money funneled out of Russia? Why do they want to take it and put it away in American real estate or banks on the island of Cyprus?
Well, you can say that there are two answers to it. One is that much of the money is stolen or corrupt. And the other answer is that Russia doesn't really have a rule of law. Property is not safe in Russia. So the banks in Russia, they are abroad. So also decent people keep their money abroad if they are wealthy enough rather than in Russian banks where they can easily lose the money.
So you say that a lot of it is stolen. Where is it stolen from?
Well, perhaps somewhat inappropriately stated, often what we would consider theft is actually legal in Russia. It is privileged state procurement. Putin's friends now get big state contracts and often charged three times as much as they should. That is, if it had been a proper competition, and the profit is theirs. And Russia does not have any capital controls, so therefore they can take out the money easily. By my assessment, Putin's group of cronies, the half dozen people closest to him, take out $10 to $20 billion a year since 2006.
$10 to $20 billion a year since 2006. Where is that money now?
Well, for example, in the U.S., how you take it into the U.S. first, you set up an LLC, an unofficial company, preferably in Delaware, can be in Wyoming, Nevada, or South Dakota, and then you transfer money through a law firm, which is covered by attorney-client privileged. And the Wall Street Journal at the end of December assessed that at least $40 billion a year goes into the U.S. in this fashion, completely anonymously, completely bypassing all bank regulations.
Do you think the FBI has the resources to break into that?
I'm not sure.
I believe Scott Horton, you said that the FBI does. It sounds pretty difficult to me.
It is difficult. And it takes a long time and a lot of hard work to break through all of it. And you run into problems like Panamanian bearer shares, which may be impossible to break through in the end of the day. But they have a track record of breaking through in many other cases. But I think what Anders says is correct. And I think a big part, and I think bringing it back more immediately to the investigation of the Trump Organization and its real estate projects, a large part of this money is clearly being invested in real estate. And we can look at what's going on in certain markets in the United States, for instance, Los Angeles, New York, and Miami, the London market, the Geneva market. These are all places where the infusion of this kleptocratic cash in the tens of billions of dollars is having an immense impact on the real estate markets. And we find lots of these properties are held as investments. They're not actually occupied. You can look at what's happened in London quite recently with the Grenfell Towers controversy. When you look in the neighboring area of leafy Kensington, a very, very wealthy area, but it's filled with empty flats, which have been purchased under regimes like the ones that Anders Osland has described.
Luke Harding, you are in London again, a foreign correspondent for The Guardian. You're in London at the moment. Is that right? Are there empty apartments? Are they deteriorating, or is somebody taking care of them?
I mean, Scott's completely right, and it's a fantastically depressing phenomenon. There are certain very posh areas of West London, Belgravia, Mayfair, Kensington, as Scott says, where of an evening you go past these kind of wonderful villas, sort of Georgian era with stucco, ivory white, and there are no lights on. There's no one there. And essentially, they're a kind of safety deposit box for Russian oligarchs, but also for other kind of kleptocrats from the former Soviet Union and elsewhere. And what's so kind of tragic about this situation is it means that ordinary people, ordinary citizens, can no longer afford to live in central London. I mean, to buy a family house costs about $2 million. So it has a kind of distorting effect on the market. And what the British government has been doing, and I've actually seen sort of senatorial hearings where similar things have been said, is to try and de-anonymize some of these offshore companies so that we know who the beneficial owners are, who the real people are behind them. But the problem is, from my kind of investigation, is that we find Russian crooks are very clever. They're very adaptable. And what they're doing is they're giving the name of their driver, their nanny, their mistress, someone else. So even, let's say, Bob Miller gets to the end of the chain, there may be a fake name there and another kind of layer of difficulty. So getting to the bottom of this is going to be tremendously hard.
Very quickly, why leave them empty? Wouldn't they decline in value if they weren't occupied? Are they waiting for the value to go up? Will it go up if, in fact, there's nobody there?
Well, I mean, in the UK, property values, at least up until kind of we had the disaster of Brexit last year, have been shooting up and up and up, and you could increase your capital by 5 or 10% a year. So I mean, the irony is that the people who steal them operate in a kind of nihilistic country with no law, proper judiciary, or institutions, and they come to places like London or New York because the attorneys are good and their assets are protected and no one can take them away from them. And it's the point I was making earlier about that you take the Western system and you exploit it for your own purposes.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back in a moment, continue this conversation with all three of our guests. And this is To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point. The special counsel, Robert Mueller, is looking into the allegations of Russian fiddling around with the American election. And, of course, that has been tied to Donald Trump, who won the election. And he has been ambiguous about sanctions against Russia. The Congress wants to impose more. He wants to lift the ones that already exist. And Scott Horton, let me go back to you at the Columbia Law School. Who are some of the people that might make it easier to trace the connections than all of the complexities that we've heard with the phony owners for property and all that sort of stuff. And what about particularly Michael Flynn, who has been reported by some to be cooperating with the special counsel? What do you suppose he could tell them?
Well, I think Flynn and Manafort are key characters involved here.
Paul Manafort, the one-time manager of the Trump campaign. Michael Flynn, of course, the former Army officer who was briefly his national security advisor. Go ahead.
Precisely. And Sheldon Whitehouse, who, of course, was a former U.S. attorney in Rhode Island and now a senator on the Intelligence Committee, has stated several times now in the course of the last week that he believes, based on what he's seen, that Flynn is actually cooperating with prosecutors. You know, we don't know the full subject matter. We do know that that Flynn was quite in the center of plans for policy changes dealing with Russia. We also know that he traveled to Moscow. He had dinner seated next to Vladimir Putin. He received money from the Russians at one point. He may know quite a bit. Paul Manafort himself also has been involved acting on behalf of very powerful figures in Russia and Ukraine, figures very, very close to Putin, has received enormous sums of money from them in the past, and has himself been involved in a mysterious business of real estate acquisition in New York. And in fact, if we look deep into those transactions he's done in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, we see he's purchasing properties in cash, and then immediately taking loans for the full value of the property. And that looks from a distance suspiciously like money laundering. Of course, we have to have the criminal predicate to say it's money laundering. But I'd say it's exactly the sort of transaction which would raise eyebrows, and I'm sure is going to be closely reviewed in this investigation.
Anders Osland with the Atlantic Council, our economic expert in Russia, Ukraine, and Eastern Europe. You were dubious, I think, that the FBI might be able to penetrate these financial connections. But would it take witnesses such as the ones we've heard, presuming that they do know something, and we certainly don't want to accuse them of anything on the radio? But is that what you think it would take in order to unravel all this?
Yeah, I would assume that a few of these people will speak, and in order to save themselves in some kind of plea bargain. I know Paul Manafort quite well myself, and of course, what he did in Ukraine was that he used Russian television in order to convince his eastern electorate to vote for Yanukovych, because in eastern Ukraine, people watch Russian television, and he clearly had a hand in running the coverage. So he has all the context that you can imagine for election manipulation on the Russian side. So I think that Paul Manafort, who's extremely skillful, he's very intelligent, very pleasant person, but he is really the spider in the net when it comes to accusations of election collusion. And I completely agree with what Scott just said. I think that there are a lot of dubious things here to figure out financially. And Manafort made big money in Ukraine. It's a question of millions of dollars a year. And he worked for Yanukovych for 9 years, and he won 3 elections for Yanukovych. Manafort is an extraordinarily skillful person, perhaps the best pollster in the world.
Yanukovych, a man, of course, who I believe is now in Russia. The Washington Post today, if you can be quick about this, has an article that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, got a major loan from the Deutsche Bank right after the election. How is the Deutsche Bank involved, Anders Osland, in all of this?
Well, good you asked about it, because I think Deutsche Bank is really a key player in this. Deutsche Bank has played a big role in Russia. It has been accused of money laundering, and it has been accused of violating the sanctions by the U.S. Authorities, and it has got away in a couple of settlements that were remarkably easy after Trump was elected president. And now it comes out today, Washington Post showed that Jared Kushner had got a $250 million loan from refinancing from Deutsche Bank in October. And Trump himself has $350 million outstanding in loans from Deutsche Bank, when no other bank wants to lend money to these people who tend to bankrupt themselves, as Scott said early on. So Deutsche Bank here is a very dubious player, well worth a serious investigation.
Scott Horton, back to you with Columbia Law School. It's going to be, it seems to me, a pretty long time to unravel all of this, assuming that everybody who's been mentioned is guilty, or excuse me, is innocent until proven guilty. So it's going to, I would assume, take a long time before we know the what actually has been going on.
Right, that's right. I think it's very hard to put a calendar on this, but it strikes me that it's unlikely that we could get to any even preliminary conclusions in under a year. I'd say if we have cooperating witnesses, if some of these key figures like Manafort, like Flynn, perhaps a few others, turned and started cooperating and providing information to the prosecutors, that might, in fact, dramatically accelerate the conclusion of the investigation.
A lot of ifs. Luke Harding, there have been reports to the effect that in Britain there have been a lot of cover-ups of dastardly activity by the Russians, including murders. How are the investigations going there?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, BuzzFeed did a report last week suggesting there have been 14 cases where both Russians and British citizens had died in mysterious circumstances. The U.S. intelligence agencies believe that this was murder and that the British authorities hadn't really got to the bottom of it. I mean, it's very hard to tell. I mean, the atmosphere here in the U.K. is so kind of febrile, especially after the Litvinenko case, which was proven and was a radioactive cup of tea, that there's always suspicion when these things occur. I mean, I think the problem is that some police forces, Scotland Yard in London, are good at this, and others are not. There's a case of a Russian dissident called Alexander Perepolichny, who collapsed 4 years ago while jogging outside his luxury mansion. And a very strange plant poison was found in his stomach. But the police are insisting there's no foul play. There's an inquest going on.
Too much to go into it. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're simply out of time. Luke Harding with The Guardian in London. His most recent book, A Very Expensive Poison. Luke Horton at Columbia Law School. Anders Osland with the Atlantic Council. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.